Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm feeling like, you know, Earth should come first, and that's how I'm feeling. That's just my pride.
I guess I never knew you.
So we are the Yum Yum Podcast, likely because of the iconic line of dialogue from Star Trek Discovery's second season, Yum Yum. A line that came out of nowhere, yet it has stuck around for the remainder of eternity. I have never forgotten it, Rachel has never forgotten it, and no one shall ever forget it when listening to this podcast, since we had to name ourselves after it. But we aren't covering Discovery anymore, we are covering Babylon 5, episode by episode, one at a time, from the rewatch viewpoint. So if you have not seen the show, you are going to be listening to us. Well, there's going to be spoilers. We've seen the show many a times and we're revisiting it, and that is the case. You have been warned. Rachel, we watched an episode that had a lot of stuff going on, but I gotta ask before you tell us the episode and the summary of it and blah 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 blah, who was the character most likely to say yum yum in this one? There was no Nagrath, so we can't get Nagrath on. Who is the yum yum candidate?
Somebody at the potential riot.
Who?
I feel like one of the aliens in the crowd, or maybe Jakar.
You're just picking random aliens? I never knew you. No, it's a hard one, isn't it? I'm having a hard time.
Then, who would you pick?
Well, jeez, I think it has to be Jakar, right?
Thank you.
I mean, he had the most, like, snippiness to him, and he said pouchling.
Yeah.
So, it has to be him.
It's a short step away.
Who do you think we are, pouchlings, Commander?
Today, the offering that Babylon 5 gives us. We are gathered here to...
Gathering.
Yeah,
the gathering. Which is referenced in this one for some reason.
Yeah. To talk about season one, episode 7, entitled The Wooa Prayer. As in, say a little prayer for you.
Okay, it is also a reference to a poem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You want to hear what the DVD offers up as the episode?
Yes, I want to hear. I know what this one offers up. I want to hear it again. Let's hear.
You're laughing in anticipation of this. Do you want to
remember? No. You got to read it. But like, remember what this says in comparison to what the episode is. Go.
I feel like there's too much pressure on this now.
No.
Babylon 5 stretches miles from one end to the other, but there's not one inch available on board for racism.
No one inch available on board for racism.
So Sinclair and Garibaldi act quickly when clandestine Home Guard members attempt a violent anti-alien campaign.
There's not one inch on board for racism. I mean, sure, in a previous episode, Garibaldi was out and out antagonistic towards aliens and their religions, but there's not one inch on board with this ship.
Intolerance acceptable as long as it doesn't cross into racism.
As long as it doesn't have real estate on Babylon 5 and operates businesses, sure, it can be the police. But if it operates a business, no, thank you.
Which is why I'm going into business here.
What?
I do believe this is the very first time I've ever surprised you.
Rachel, the war prayer. What is your relationship and history with this episode?
I always forget about the A plot.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I remember this episode as being Londo's episode with the speech that he gives in the garden. Yes. That's the main thing that I remember. I remember that big character moment. And the A-plot balances it well. Well enough. With, like, it goes for a different tact.
Yes.
There's a very clear contrast between the two stories. But they do connect and reflect upon each other nicely.
So my history has been very complicated with this one. I don't know if I like it or not, even now. I remember I rejected this one when I first saw it. When I first saw it when I was a young child.
A pouchling, you might say.
When I was a pouchling, thank you. I rejected this because it did not meet the standards of science fiction that I was accustomed to. AKA, Star Trek wouldn't be like this. Star Trek wouldn't make Earth such a fucking nightmare world where everyone's got, like, fucking bigotries and there's hate groups stabbing people. Sure, there would be some, but when I saw it when I was young and I was just familiar with TNG and the original series and Voyager and DS9, you know, it was very confronting to be presented a sci-fi show in which Earth has these hate groups who go around being horrid, and they even, you know, and there's even bigotry within our own society in this show, and I rejected it. I just went, no thank you. And I also rejected the classic Ivanova's old lover comes to the station kind of plot. I rejected that. I still kind of do reject that.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, it needs to be somebody that she knows, and this is very effective shorthand that makes sense and adds to her character as well, but it is very clearly there is a shortcut.
Yes.
And it feels like the idea has been used already.
But eventually I have warmed up to this because, and the racism aspect of the show, because it is a central part of the show. This episode is the real punch to the face early on in presenting one of the core aspects of the story, which is the bigotry that's inherent within the Earth, the society, that will eventually boil up to a breaking point later in the show and will become more and more insidious and more sinister. So I have accepted the aspect that I initially rejected because that is what Babylon 5 is exploring. Star Trek explores bigotry and racism and sexism, all these things, but they use aliens and sci-fi stuff as allegories to our real world, and not always using the internal of the human society to explore that. Not saying that they don't, they do, but not in the way that Babylon 5 does, not in this pessimistic way where Babylon 5 does it, in which this episode ends on a tragic note in a lot of ways. And yes, we got the bad guys, but in the end, it's like the bad guys are still around, and who knows how high they go.
These people might have been arrested, but it's not the end of it. It's not the solution.
No, and the fact of the matter is, it's that overwhelming sense that maybe it's the people like Sinclair and Garibaldi and Ivanova who are the minority in the human society rather than the majority. Unfortunately, that's the overwhelming presence you get from this episode, is maybe the Babylon 5's living in this isolated little bubble of a utopian ideal, while the actual society that built this utopian ideal isn't even trying to
and
do that.
You really begin to appreciate on the rewatch that this episode really signals that people really like the idea of Babylon 5.
Some do.
No, like, the...
like, our core characters.
No, like, all of these worlds like the idea of looking like they're seeking peace.
Yeah, but, except for the Warlords. They don't give a flying fuck about that. They're just fucking weirdos.
The Volans are the exception to almost everything.
Yeah, and the makers of the rules. But I rejected it, and now revisiting it for this discussion, I still have a very hard time with this, not because of its confronting nature, but because I think that this episode is very messy and very sloppy, but it has so many good things in there and so many things that are important to the grander scope of the show thematically rather than plot-wise. And this episode is frustrating because it is commenting upon things in a way that I don't necessarily disagree with, but I don't find it dramatically engaging enough the way that it should be. And I think a lot of the execution writing-wise and directorial-wise are very lacking. But I'm not opposed to the actual narrative being presented here, but I struggle to think, like, I think to myself, how could this be better? Because I feel like this needs to be done better. Like, if you kept this story, how do you make it better? Like, this is the episode's plot. How do you make it better?
And yep,
we'll talk about it as we go along, but I still struggle to think about how we make it better, how you make it better, other than, like, make it less corny in its direction, edit it tighter, get rid of some corny, cheesy comedy music, and eject some of the stuff we like, which is, you know, the Londo stuff is so polar opposite to what's going on. Yet it does tie in, and we'll obviously discuss it, but I always feel like it's undermining the racism alien plot, in which I want that to be solely the plot.
Here is the way that I want to summarize my current relationship with this episode. It was enjoyable, but it wasn't satisfying.
You know what that victory tasted like? Ashes.
I want to talk about a character that we really haven't discussed.
He's
been in there, but we haven't discussed Ambassador Kosh that much. We've had episodes with him and we've made little jabs about him being here, because Kosh hasn't, although Kosh was a plot point in the movie, Kosh wasn't,
he's more of a MacGuffin than a character.
Well, Kosh was the inciting incident for a lot of things, but we haven't really talked about Kosh because Kosh has just been there here and there saying cryptic shit, and there's lots of stuff we could have talked about to, like, in reference to rewatching the show and how on a rewatch Kosh's nonsense actually makes sense. Like, if you understand the Volon ideology and you understand Kosh's character, most of the things, if not all of them, in retrospect, make sense. But we just haven't talked about him because in the episodes, there's just so many other things going on. So many big things that we have to catch up on. Like, in the very first episode, we have to talk about, like, what that was like as a second pilot to the show and all these new characters and da-da-da. Kosh has been kind of left to the side, but I think it's time. He's only in one scene in this episode, but I think it's time we kind of talk about him. What was your experience seeing this thing Kosh introduced into the show when you were first watching it? What were your feelings about this character whose entire entity as a being in the show is a giant question mark?
I found him very annoying.
You didn't like Kosh?
I liked Kosh. I didn't like the experience of not knowing what the fuck was going on with Kosh, and you refused to tell me anything and would use Kosh's lines back at me.
Yes.
So that made it less enjoyable and very frustrating in the moment.
But you were hooked in wanting to know.
Yeah, I was just like, what the fuck? Like, everything else is, like, so deliberate and articulate. I was like, this is gonna do something, right? This is like, eventually we'll understand.
Most of the other things in the show, even the mysterious threads like Sinclair's war story, are very well defined, where you as an audience trust that you know where this is, you know that this is going to go down a path. But Kosh wasn't as defined as that for you, is that correct?
Yeah, I guess so.
He's just like this mysterious thing in which you know eventually they're going to show you what's inside the suit. But there was no guarantee necessarily that you were going to understand that any of his cryptic bullshit means anything other than just being like poetic.
Yeah, I was just like, okay. Like, why the fuck are the Volans even here when they don't do or participate in anything?
They don't interact very often.
And you don't even get the impression that they're watching or paying any attention.
Or have interests.
And it's just like, well, like, why the fuck are you putting money and resources into this? You
like the show itself.
You helped make Babylon 5, right? You got a place on the council.
Yeah, yeah. You're one
you
of the
send
main guys.
An ambassador.
A very secretive race.
And you're like, we'll just chill.
We'll just
and apparently
observe.
Just watch this unique view screen.
So Kosh is a mystery character. Do those type of characters enthrall you that often? Because we have talked on in our Discovery episodes how much we don't personally care for the mystery box type of story, especially if it's not followed through upon. You could argue, and you could definitely say that Babylon 5 does mystery box stuff a lot, that it has mysterious threads, but we know as someone who has watched the show from beginning, middle, and end, that there's...
The creator knew what was in the box.
That there's answers. Like, are you drawn naturally, or have you been drawn naturally to the instinct of being, you know, hooked for the mystery?
Hooked, yes. But I am a very impatient person. Mm-hmm. So I get very annoyed when I get dangled along. Mm. And they do that for a long time with Kosh.
Yeah.
But then the payoff was, like, so satisfying, particularly on that first watch through of being like, oh, my. Yes. Yes. This, it makes so much sense. And now all of these other things have changed because, like, we have this revelation and it means so much more because it is at that specific point.
Mm.
But I hated the process of having to be patient and wait, and I was not good.
Now,
imagine
if you were a child and had this and this alone this season for 3 fucking years like I did. Kosh,
you are so much more patient.
My
than
interest
me.
In well, I didn't have the internet at the time to look this stuff up anyway.
Oh, yeah,
but my interest in Kosh went from being intrigued to being pissed off to where I am now and where I have been for many years, which is amused. Kosh is funny to me.
You love
every
watching
time,
other people
every time.
Suffer through Kosh.
Not even that. When Kosh comes in a scene and he's in his big goofy suit and he's making those warbly noises and he's saying poetic stuff that actually makes sense in context when you know what he's about, I still chuckle. I chuckle and I laugh a lot. I think he's a very funny thing to put in the show. Like, if I was creating my sci-fi opera show, I don't know if I would be bold enough to put an ancient alien godlike being just casually in the cast and having him pop in and out to warble and say nonsense things and then warble out of a scene and every now and then just remind you, I'm the most powerful fucking being in the entire show and I'm not going to help you.
The
Fuck
temptation
you.
For lots of people would be like, we've sunk a lot of money into this costume. Like, it still looks ridiculous.
I love it. I want it. I want to wear
it. It's a solid full outfit.
And it moves around. It makes little noises.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of detail in it. And they don't cram Kosh into episodes so that they can justify the expense. He's there because he needs to be.
The thing about Kosh I appreciate, for let's say 90% of the time, he does not serve what this type of character would usually serve in these shows. He is not the wise sage deus ex machina character all of the time like you would think he is. He is not the dragon from Merlin, like where the character goes and talks to them and they have a thematic back and forth and the main character has a realization thanks to this talk. People go to Kosh and they walk out going, why the fuck did I go to Kosh? I don't know why I did that.
Like, I know I had a reason for going in there.
And there's a long-term
game. Why did I ever think that that was going to be
beneficial? Yeah.
Like, I went in there for something and I've come out.
Don't know why I went in there.
With, like, it's not even as simple as I walk in there wanting to get answers and I leave with more questions than I started with.
So
that is part of it.
So for myself, as a longtime viewer and someone with a unique history of being stuck with season one for 3 years before seeing the rest of the show, I take for granted how intrigued people get when they watch the show by Kosh. Because I lost that intrigue and it grew into frustration and then eventual tedium and then blah, blah, blah. And now it's amusement. And that's not the show's fault. That's just how the nature of the beast of my experience. So I personally take for granted how hungry people are to know what's underneath that encounter suit or why is he saying these things and what's the Vorlon's agenda and why is he even in the show? I take that for granted. But when watching this episode, he pops in because Sinclair comes in to tell him that there's been some attacks and he's just basically like, hey, chill out, they might come for you, but hey, like, are you worried about that? And Kosh just warbles on.
Like, you haven't replied to my messages.
Yeah,
so
you haven't read my DMs.
You left me unread. So I come by your place, just want to check in.
I want to make sure you're right. Can we have a cuddle?
Kosh actually gives a direct answer.
Yes.
I was thinking more of good.
Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kosh,
like,
revels.
He actually makes a judgment of, like, good.
Good.
It's one sentence, but it's actually
one
direct.
Word. Yeah. But the scene is iconic to me because Kosh is viewing this television screen and it's just flashing with random images from Earth, like, relatively quickly with no, and you know that he's processing something from that, and he says as much. It's like, I'm studying, and it's like, you know, what's he studying? And he shuts off. That's like one of the funniest fucking scenes to me in the entire show. Is if Kosh doesn't want to talk to you, his suit just shuts off and his eye closes and you just have to walk away. It's an ultimate conversation killer. But Kosh has a very great line that is wonderful when you are revisiting the show. When Sinclair's kind of having the back and forth with him about everything going on and about the studying and all of that. And he basically, Sinclair's like, hey, do you want to engage with anything in the show? Like, hey, Kosh, are you at all interested in the plot?
Are you going to be a character?
Are you going to have an opinion on anything here? Kosh, are you going to be someone with a third dimension? And Kosh says, we take no interests in the affairs of others. And that line is great
and
because
such a big fucking lie.
Kosh is such a bullshit artist.
All the Vorlons are.
The Vorlons' whole entire thing is meddling with us all.
Their fucking purpose is to meddle with other
races. To take interest in the affairs of others.
And to make sure that they follow what the Vorlons see as the right path.
But the great thing about the line is he's not lying necessarily because the Vorlons have such a apathy and detached nature to their interference in the affairs of others. They don't even see it like that anymore.
No.
They've been around for who knows how long, and they've been tweaking and meddling with societies and guiding them into places for their grander war and their grander schemes, the big game at play, that they have just kind of, like, coasted along on that for so long that they've forgotten that is actually the point. They are taking interest in the affairs of others. That, to them, at this point, is just what it is. That is the order of things. We manipulate you for you to do the good that is needed. They don't even... So Kosh saying that, it's a big fucking lie, but in the same way...
It's not a lie to him.
It's not a lie to him. I don't think it's a blatant lie to him because they, the Vorlons, have detached themselves so thoroughly from the emotional states or the ramifications of their actions upon others that that statement is true to him and is true to the Vorlons. We don't take interest in the affairs of others because we made your affairs. We don't care now.
No.
You will just... The dominoes will fall into place because we set them up to fall in the way we want them
they
to.
They really do see other races as ants. Like, what do I don't care about what an individual ant is doing.
And that's great because in the previous episode in Mind War, Jakar had that whole conversation about the aliens that Catherine ran into, and he used that analogy as well, where it's like, we are ants to them, like, how do they communicate with us? But the interesting thing about the Vorlons in comparison to the other first races is they have now, due to the Babylon 5 project, and they know about Sinclair and where he's going to go and all of this, these aliens that don't understand ants have now decided to live with the ants.
Yeah.
And still observe them.
Honey,
like
I shrunk the kids logic,
yeah.
I guess.
And I can't overstate what a fucking ballsy yet well-performed move it is of JMS to have in the show basically a god character in there. Because that could ruin everything. But they use Kosh the right amount of times for you to forget that there's a god character on the show. And then when he does pop up, you're thinking, oh, well, it's the ancient alien god character who's the benevolent wise, they're going to help out. And then he doesn't. He doesn't really help out. It takes him a while to do fucking anything. And that's the exact issue with the Vorlons. They don't do anything when they should be doing something.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it portrays a unique kind of take on religion, because Kosh is a god, an angel, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. And is indifferent.
Apathetic.
Which is something that we don't associate with that imagery.
Yeah, and that's what makes the Vorlons, in a way, so dastardly and perverted. They have manufactured the divinity of most of the races.
Yeah.
And the horrifying thing is the idea of what happens if we met the angels and the gods and they didn't care about us is a very interesting thing to explore. And here we are in episode 7 of the show, and you have this one throwaway line from Kosh that seems throwaway at the time, but when you are revisiting it, it is one of those lines that makes you laugh and shaken to the core, because if you know what the Vorlons are all about, that line is fraught.
We take no interest in the affairs of others.
These two young lovers arrive on board, under the impression that
the is Ambassador.
Ambassador Kodo.
Ambassador Kodo.
Because Veer has lied to his family.
You know what's great about that, though? Mm-hmm. It sets up early on, although Veer is a good character, he's a good man, he is willing to abuse his station of power and lie to benefit himself. And thankfully, as the show goes on, he'll use that to be beneficial to others, especially with the Narns later. Mm-hmm. But it is an interesting little touch to put there that Veer is actually capable of like manipulation and lies when thus far he's just presented as a boob. He's been like a dumb guy.
And they do somewhat try and pay it off as like, oh, it's hard to explain. And it's just like, no, it's fairly straightforward, Veer, that you lied about what your position was. But anyway, so these two arrive because they were running away from Centauri Prime because they'd been both placed into arranged marriages.
One, but he has the ugliest woman on Centauri Prime and she has like the oldest man on Centauri Prime.
And then obviously because the Centauri have had arranged marriages
for like thousands of years.
And it means like the fact that their future spouses are so unattractive means that they must be a great match.
Yeah, I love Londa. That's Londa's perspective. And this whole story is very interesting world building for the Centauri. But as always is the case, interesting world building for the Centauri is actually secretly interesting character work and building for Londo Mollari. Because as interesting as it is to know that the Centauri are a culture based on appearances and power, and they use that even to the form of marriage, in which marriage is not done for love, but for status and power, all interesting, but what it really is there to do is to reflect back on Londo himself. Londo is somebody who had to sacrifice love, give up love to uphold tradition, and he's clearly unhappy about it. He's married to these three women who are horrifying, and he names them, you know, after the horsemen of the apocalypse, and
he hunts pestilence,
famine, and death. And I love that the normal music that's used for the dramatic sting, and you even hear it later in this episode, like that dramatic sting music is used on just a still shot of their pictures, and Via reacts to it, and it's like the dramatic sting music, and it was very funny. Now, that was a good moment of humor. But yeah, the world building there about the arranged marriages is great, but we learn so much about Londo and so much about Via. Let's talk about Via's aspect in this story. I would say
Via
that this
is so hopeful
and naive.
Yeah.
I would say that this is the first episode in which Via is given a character.
Yeah, I agree.
Outside of jokes. Thus far, he becomes a person. He becomes someone with a point of view and convictions. Because although we haven't seen much of Lanier and much of Natoth, I would say out of the three attachés in the first season, Veer is the one who walks away being the strongest defined character in terms of he has his own convictions that go against the grain of the society and against their ambassador that they work for.
Oh, yeah, because Natoth is so on board with the way that Jakar is.
Oh, yeah.
At the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
Lanier is there to serve.
Yeah.
And to be in love.
Yeah.
So, but Via in this episode, I remember when I first watched it, I was, even though I was rejecting the show, I was taken a little bit aback because I was expecting him just to be the comedy relief for the whole thing. I wasn't expecting this nuance here of him standing up to Londo and saying, "You're wrong. What's wrong with breaking tradition and actually trying to, you know, form something new to actually experience love?" You know, we've been presented with Via as just being a yes man, just being pathetic, or being a little bit of a coward, a nervous Nelly.
Game console to
a diplomatic meeting, yeah.
Negotiations about entire worlds.
And this is the turning point for Via from being, he's still going to be a comedic character the whole way through, but this is a beginning of a turning point of making a comedic side character have a nuance to them. And it will be more nuances added to Via, to the point in which I would say Via is probably one of the characters, if not the character in the show, that I would call the heart of it all.
Yeah, he really does change and evolve quite a lot.
You know, I love the guy, and I love Stephen First in this episode. He's very over the top in a lot of scenes.
All of those reaction shots, like in the med bay scene as well
as at the very end, yeah.
At the very end, but all like his entire, like every reaction shot of
Veer
him in this
priceless
episode is great. But the other scene that I was referring to was the one with the three wives.
Yeah, and but that's a great thing is you get the juxtaposition of he plays a comedic and over the top and that Veer persona that we have come to know and love, but when the time calls for it, Stephen First plays Veer very low energy. To show us that there is another layer to him. Like during the famous speech from Londo about the shoes, you know, Stephen First is playing it great. He's reacting in the right way. He's not clowning around. He's not gurning. And it just shows us that, hey, maybe there's more to this other Centauri character. Maybe he has a point of view, and I respect the fact that he comes up to Londo in the garden and just says, you were wrong about that, actually. You know, I know I don't have much of a voice here, and I kind of screwed things up by pretending to be ambassador, but, you know, they're going to, like, one of them could die right now, and here we are thinking about tradition over life or love, and it's wrong. And it's a big moment for the guy. It's a big moment for him. And yet you may not know it when you're first watching the show. But that is going to be a defining character trait of Veer's, is he will stand up and give out his opinion. He won't be actually afraid after a certain period of time to voice his convictions.
And it's not going to be the only time, I don't think it's the first time even, that we've praised the show for something being even more rewarding on the rewatch.
Of course, it's one of the many things that we're going to be talking about as we go along. Londo himself. We keep talking about Londo in many episodes.
Is it time to discuss the speech?
I would say that as much as I have loved his previous conversations and speeches in Born to the Purple especially, I think that, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think for most first-time viewers that I've encountered, this is the memorable speech, like the first big memorable Londo moment outside of like his laugh-out-loud moments.
There is a very clear reason why I think of this episode for that scene. When I'm like, oh, yeah, but that's the episode with this speech.
Yeah.
And it's so heartbreaking in a very gentle way.
But it has a positive outcome.
Yeah, like it does positively influence him, but you, especially on the rewatch, know that Londo's never gonna get to dance again.
He'll have his moments.
He will have his moments, but it is just a truth for him that his shoes are too tight and I have forgotten how to dance.
So, with the conversation, it's spurred on, though, by him getting confronted by the poet, Charles Mayan, who got branded and stabbed at the start of the episode. And she has a back and forth with him about how he's acting towards these two young lovers in the med bay.
And how sentient life can be best judged
by the capacity for love. And Londo, you know, he rejects her to begin with because she's a poet, rejects her because she's not Centauri, and then rejects that because, well, the girl shall learn to live without love. And, of course, the poet slams it right back, saying, like, just like you did. And it eats, you see it from that quick reaction shot. It just gets him. It gets, gets right to the core because we don't know much about Londo's history at this
point. But we know enough about what happened with Adira.
Yeah, and you just know that Londo's a sad person. Yeah. And
you know that there are many other lost loves in Londo Mollari's life.
And that, not just that as well, but just he has lived his life for the Centauri way of being. And look where it has gotten him. Nowhere. For in his view, he is depressed. His better days are gone. All of that. And when this woman tells him, like, yep, you sacrificed love for tradition. And how did that go for you? And he has no real... He can't retort against that, so he has to reflect upon it. And he reflects back upon this story that we hear that is... This is JMS at his writing thing. And I know, like, DC Fontana wrote this episode, but... You know, I wouldn't be surprised if JMS put this one in here, because this is such a JMS speech. And I think it sticks with you because as great as Born to the Purple is, you get lots of soft, reflective moments. Peter Jurasik and the character of Londo, this is a real quiet moment. This is him thinking about his life, internalizing it, and not rejecting it, but accepting it. And using it to be a positive influence for something greater than himself. He takes a story about his father, who's crying in his bedroom at night, alone in the dark, and he turns it into something that can help. He realizes, look, my shoes are too tight and I've forgotten how to dance, and what a sad thing that is. I don't want these young lovers to ever feel that, or you, Via, to ever understand that feeling, because... Children should be able to dance. And he's ecstatic at the end of the episode. You know, he's very dismissive throughout the whole entire episode. He's like, ah, love, it's overrated.
He's
who
so
needs it?
Beaten down
yeah.
by his responsibility
and tradition.
Tradition and also the weight of his failures.
Yeah.
Because he does see himself as a failure.
The dramatic irony being for Londo and for the Centauri people is you have to sacrifice all of these parts of yourself to uphold the image, to uphold the standards. But why are you upholding the images and the standards to get the things that you're sacrificing in a lot of ways? If I sacrifice this for tradition, then I'm going to get the things that tradition allows, which means I'll be happy. But you have in fact sacrificed the things that will make you happy for that pursuit, and in the end you've forgotten that what you were doing this all for was for a sense of purpose and a sense of happiness, and for Londo, for love. It's great, and I don't know how it ties into the rest of the episode. Like, this story I like so much. I know, like, how they tied in plot-wise. Like, the lovers get stabbed by the human guys and the poets there. But I don't know if this story, this speech, necessarily belongs within this episode. To the point in which you forget that this speech and this story is connected to this A plot.
Yeah.
Because...
I did say that, didn't I?
It's there.
I can't really defend it
like,
now.
I love this B plot, but it feels like it's there to pad out the running time. And I don't mean that in...
It feels like, okay, we got to do this and we got to do this. Okay, we'll pair these two things together and it'll go in episode 7.
See, for me, I prefer my A's and B plots to tie into one another more cohesively.
Oh, you prefer just having an A plot?
I do honestly prefer
like
just a solid
like,
A plot
episode.
Be honest
with what you want.
What do you want?
Okay, we have to talk about the fashion. The fashion.
Okay, that sweater is atrocious, and I do
everyone
think
knows
that
which sweater. We don't even need to clarify. You know the sweater.
There is only one sweater. In this episode, right?
There's some funky clothes.
Like, for a character that's...
Maybe.
Involved.
But here's my statement about the sweater. I think... we might see some contenders, but I think I'm gonna put my stake on the table here. I'm going to put my claim down. I'm going to plant the flag. This is the ugliest piece of costuming in the entire show.
Yeah.
And it's the most 90s thing in the entire show.
And it's okay.
And it's hideous. Okay. It's hideous, and it doesn't even match the character wearing it.
No. But I just want to take a brief aside for a moment.
Oh, Ivanova's dress is hideous too. I don't want to miss that one.
No. It matters that they dress the Australian in wool. Because this was a very strange time, for, like, in the 90s fashion-wise, because for some reason, Australian wool manufacturers managed to convince the entire world...
That's our thing.
That's our thing. Everybody should have Australian wool sweaters. And then they stuck the Australian in the ugliest fucking thing possible. And it's just really weird because it's a representation of that time of, like, fashion being really into wool sweaters.
Yeah.
With very ugly patterns. Like, when I think of this trend, I think of Princess Diana with the one with the koala. And I was like, that's fairly acceptable. But then you get this. And it's just like, what did we force upon the world?
Malcolm Biggs is the character. He's a former flame of Ivanova's and he's a supremacist. He's a racist, xenophobic, hate monger. He's one of my least favorite one-off characters in the entire show. Not because of the actor, not because of his Australian-ness, which, yes, it is bizarre to me when I see an Australian in a show like this and they're actually played by an Australian for a start. That's fucking weird to me because most of the time they get Americans to do shitty accents of Australians, and we will even see that later in Babylon 5.
Throwing massive shade on The Good Place.
Yeah, season 3 and 4, The Good Place, get your shit together.
We'll never forgive it.
But Malcolm Biggs is one of my least favorite one-off characters because I don't buy him. There's this level of, like, I don't buy that he was ever in a relationship with Ivanova. I don't understand how she was in a relationship with this guy. They never really try to develop it to be understandable. The two actors don't have any chemistry at all. And he's so obviously slimy and so obviously evil that it's boring to watch. Every time he comes on, you're like, yeah, that's the bad
guy.
Agree. Can we just get to that? In fact, I kind of wish that they scripted it like they all knew he came on and it's like, oh, he's a home guards person, but we can't do anything about them because they haven't done anything yet. Like, that's how I wish they framed it, because we all know that he's a bad guy. And we all know that they're using this former lover plot to put some doubt upon that because, well, if Ivanova could have gotten with him, then there must be something. There's even a fucking lame-ass line that's like a throwaway where they cut to the Fresh Air restaurant and he just says some line that's just like, oh, yeah, we really did have good old times back in the day, didn't we, Ivanova? We never heard what they were. We never get an understanding of how they liked one another, how they knew one another. We don't care.
At least 3 times that it was 8 years ago.
Yeah, and, but we're different now.
Yeah, we don't get any details.
We know that
we
know their relationship broke up because she's career driven and she took a job and left him behind and he got bitter about that. But I don't like, he's one of my least favorites because it's that old lover plot. But in this case, I don't even buy the fact that they were ever old lovers. Not just because Ivanova is clearly gay or bisexual or whatever JMS has to say about the character, but it's just because they do such poor character work with him.
Yeah.
That I kind of wish that they didn't add that aspect to his character. I do wish that he was just a well-known Home Guard spokesperson that came on the ship and they had to deal with him instead of leaving it till near halfway through the episode for them to discover that. It is a vacuum of boredom watching the episode because of that. I look at this and I want to restructure and I want to just reshape it. And I don't know if my version would be better or not, but I find him an aggravation.
It's just like, it's just very awkward in lots of ways, so it just sticks and stops you from enjoying other things that are happening because we are both like, don't buy it, don't care, hurry up.
Yep.
No, wait, why did you skip over that part? That part could have been really interesting. And now, oh, now we just get this.
And see, the thing about putting in your writing a villainous figure on an episode having a relationship to one of our main characters, like a previously established rapport, is for that moment of seeing our main character...
The betrayal.
To see the main character have the dawning realization that this person isn't who they knew. But that doesn't work here because I didn't feel the tragedy, because he is a two-dimensional racist caricature, which is a dangerous road to walk, because with what the Home Guard are and with what how I know real life versions of these guys to be, I don't want him to be more than what he is. But the show is trying to add this extra level by making him a former lover of Ivanova, to have that moment at the end in which she said, well, I never knew you.
Yeah.
To hit hard, but it never hits hard because I don't buy it.
They thought that line sounded great. That's what it feels like. It doesn't feel like, oh.
They did a better job with Vance in Infection. They did it better because, you know what happened with Vance in Infection? He was with Franklin the whole fucking episode, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Having back and forth. We knew he was evil, but there was at least a glimmer of something there. Here, there's no glimmer. It's just there to add this extra layer, but it's not anything special. It's not actually real. It feels like an artifice.
I don't know you anymore.
I never knew you.
Let's talk about the racism aspect of the story and how you could say this is very prophetic. A lot of people now label this as the MAGA episode, the Make America Great Again episode. I mean, what the show is touching upon is the cyclical nature of nationalism that keeps rising up again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
It's this, I mean, obviously they say it here, Earth first, which now in nowadays context we have here Australia first and there's America first and Britain first. These aren't new things. These have been around for a very long time.
And you said what it is, which is the cyclical nature of nationalism.
And that is what this is commenting upon. And since it's commenting upon it and using the language that has been used in the past and still being used today,
it promotes those ideals that come up again.
The rhetoric rarely, if ever, actually changes.
No, you swap out nouns.
Yeah, and you use modern context things, but usually a lot of the rhetoric is the same rhetoric. And thus, this episode does also have a weird timeless quality to it, in which it feels relevant still to this day. I don't want the Home Guard guys to be these nuanced, tactical, genius villains in this episode, because the type of xenophobic racists that these guys are reflecting upon these ones that we see so much, that we look at on the news and see in the streets in these rallies, and you just react to them like they're fucking idiots.
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
what I needed from these guys in this episode. That's all I needed. The show will go deeper and more nuanced with the xenophobia of Earth, but as the warm-up act to that, mm-hmm. the violent, dumb, hate-filled, two-dimensional racist caricature types are exactly what is needed here. But at the same time, it's done in such a frustrating manner, because here's my thing. I say this all the time. I've said it a lot. This needed to be the only plot in the episode. If the whole episode was about Sinclair having to basically open up his own internal racism and make it external to ingratiate himself into this hate group to undermine it, that would have been great. It would have given us a character-driven episode. The only character-driven thing that we get out of this episode that's fully defined is Londo's. And I don't know how it ties into the A-plot all that much. And we're supposed to have it with Ivanova, but like we said, I don't fucking buy Ivanova's relationship with this guy for a singular moment. So her character journey doesn't feel true. So you have this thing here with Sinclair having to be openly a racist. And by the end of the episode, it's wrapped up. And it's like, well, no, Sinclair, you pretended to be a fucking Earth first xenophobe to all these alien ambassadors. I don't think it just wipes away clean after the episode's over, but in this one it does, and it feels so false with how the show is, with how the show always mentions how these little things and big things linger and affect and keep moving on. But in this episode, him doing all of this stuff never's referenced again, and no one ever treats him with a side eye view because of it. Yet I feel like that should have been the case. If this was the whole plot, Homeguarder on the station, and Sinclair has to weigh up his options and grapple with his own internal bigotries that he's still carrying from the war,
yeah,
that would have been an episode. And yet, for some reason, this is trying to do so many other things instead of that. To me, it's so clear that that's what it should have been. And also, I don't know if you agree with this, but one of the most interesting aspects of the show, too, was the bigotry of the humans spawning the bigotries of the aliens. Seeing the Drazi attack that guy and Jakar rally riots and all of that. That feels like what the episode should have been.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons of hate begets hate. But it's kind of there. It's mm-hmm. not fully breaking through. Like, why do you think that is? Do you think it is just it's trying to do too much? Do you think they just... What do you think about that?
I think it's too much for this episode and they build on it later. That's... To me, that must have been partially, like, a justification that they offered of, like, okay, we're going to do these little things. We're not going to fully get to them this episode because we're going to get to them later.
Yeah.
Which makes this episode, like I said, just a little bit, like, not satisfying. Because it doesn't get to those things. It doesn't reach its full potential, but you get to see the glimpses of all of these things that could be or that are really good but maybe don't belong in this episode.
Yeah, but I do struggle, though, because Babylon 5 will kind of pivot away from this and go towards the more insidious, systematic racism that's in the world. But there is something to be said about this episode presenting the upfront, horrid, violent, grotesque, hate crime type of racism. Like, I was actively uncomfortable the way the episode wanted me to with them performing the hate crimes, with them branding her at the start and stabbing her at the start, and then the aliens getting spawned to attack that guy, and it just kept spiraling out of control, and then attacking the teenage lovers, and it made me deeply uncomfortable. And I think, like, Babylon 5 needed to show this type of bigotry as well, but it will later go on to do, like I said, the insidious and systematic, which in turn feels like it's done better because it's more subtle. Mm. But the thing is, racism, hate like this, it's not subtle in real life. You look at it when you see the TV, you look at it when you walk down the streets and you see these Nazi graffitis things, and you just gawk at it because it's just like, how are we this disgusting still?
And there is a part of that plot that I really want to make sure that we address, which is the branding. The Minbari that is branded on the forehead with the Home Guard symbol,
which is like the male female gender symbol.
Mm-hmm. I love how simply and succinctly she refuses Franklin's offer to get it removed.
Yes, and that it's a reminder, it's a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I have had issues, though, with the branding, because this is maybe it's a 90s thing or a budgetary thing. The stabbing is done well. But I've always had an issue with when they brand her, because she's on her back and her Minbari prosthetics is pushing forward because she's got her head on the ground. So her forehead's like all fucked up. So when they brand her at the beginning, it doesn't look that effective because it's fucked up. And also, my biggest thing is I do wish if you're going to have written in your script, and then they fucking brand her on her forehead, it didn't look like a little stamp. Yeah. Like, that's the thing. I think if you're going to be, and this may have just been a 90s thing, like a TV constraint, yeah. But I wish that it was more fucked up. But instead, it's like a little stamp on her head, and it looks pathetic for what is supposed to be so impactful.
Yeah, I think I appreciate the messaging and thematic purpose behind that. Because for me, it's evocative of Auschwitz tattoos, right?
Yeah.
With the prisoner numbers. If, like, lots of people have asked those survivors, why don't they get it removed?
Because it's a reminder. Hmm. But that's the issue with the episode. It's not necessarily the ideas, but it's about the execution of said ideas, whether it's the execution within the script or execution in the production, acting, directing.
I could remove that, Mark.
No. It is a lesson. One that should not be forgotten.
Is it time for the spotlight?
Yes, our actor spotlight, in which we highlight an actor in the episode. We go over who they are, what we thought of them in the given episode, and so on and so forth. Of course, we have to talk about Malcolm Biggs. He's our Australian representative. He's, as far as I remember, the only real Australian in the show in a prominent role. So,
and he's not even an Australian citizen anymore.
But he is Australian, you know, like, he's from here.
He was born in Melbourne.
So what's the actor's name? He has a great name.
Yeah. Tristan Rogers.
That sounds like an old school Australian private school boy name. Like he must have went to a private school.
It sounds like James Bond's classmate.
Villain. His arch nemesis. Like his school arch nemesis. it's you, Tristan Rogers.
So he is now officially a naturalized U.S. citizen. I don't know when he defected.
I would say, I think he defected pretty early on because I looked through his IMDb and he's only, IMDb-wise, done relatively few amount of Australian productions and mostly American television, mainly soap operas. But I want to talk about what we thought about him as an actor in this episode. We have major problems with the Malcolm Biggs character, but what did you think of his performance? I mean, he's working with what he's working with.
Smarmy as fuck.
But good or what?
Yeah, I think it works for the character. For me, it really feels like a performance that he's developed on his own and then he's come into the show and hasn't adapted it enough or, like, he hasn't had enough time with the actress of Ivanova to get that chemistry going.
He feels like a television soap opera actor.
Because he is.
Who has walked onto a sci-fi show and he's treating it just like the television soap opera he's from.
Yeah.
He's not great. He's not terrible, but he's not great. I think it's because he's given such clunky lines. Like, that whole entire conversation he has with the guy that got beaten up by the Drazi, it was so poorly, like, overtly written. It was just terrible. And the guy, I mean, you can't make those lines come out good.
Nah.
But
thankless job.
I almost thought he was pretty good in this until one moment, and it's right near the end, in which he's telling the plan about how they're going to kill everyone.
All of the, like,
and it's stupid. It's stupid because the writing is so overwrought. It's just telling you so much. Like, why would this guy reveal their big grand scheme before Sinclair has proven himself by shooting this alien, right? Like, it's so stupid. It's there for us, the audience.
Yeah.
That's all it's there for. But he has this moment where he's, like, listing off the ambassadors and he's going through them. And for some reason, he really decided as an actor with the aliens who have really alien names, he's going to, like struggle with it. Like I'm saying this gross alien name. Like, I understand.
Yeah, like, I hate that this is coming out of my
mouth.
Like,
Londo and Dylan. And he really relishes saying Jaka. But then the last one is so silly. He says Kosh, But and watch the guy's mouth when he says Kosh. He says, "And Ambassador Kosh." And he's like, him as an actor is trying to make it sound like Kosh is such a foreign name to say, but it's really not, because it's so similar to Josh.
Yep.
And Tosh and like so on and so forth. That you just, the actor tried to do something there, but it didn't work.
Nah.
And I always remember that moment from him, like outside of the sweater. I always remember him trying to make Kosh sound like it's some like foreign name that's like so dirty to say from my English tongue. And as a fellow Australian, it's really not. Like, Rachel, Kosh. As someone with the last name Slawinski, I can fucking tell you, Kosh is not one of those names that you can go like, ugh, foreign name out of my mouth. Slawinski is. I say it every fucking day of my life, and it's still one of those words that I'm just like, Slawinski? Whoa, there's like too many eyes. This guy tried to shoot his load there, and it didn't work.
No.
One night, we'll take out the four major ambassadors stationed here. Alari, Delenn, Jakar, and Kosh.
I do have some facts from his trivia on IMDb. The first one I'm just going to read out because I think it's fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know how true it is, but, you know. Argument to be made. Was the first Australian actor to gain popularity using his native Australian accent. Tristan's rapid rise in popularity is credit with the beginning of the genesis of the American fascination with all things Australian.
Because he's like in every soap opera. Like, I looked him up. I didn't know that these soap opera actors could be in all of the other ones as like major characters. Like, he's in Bold and Beautiful, General Hospital, so many others.
He was in General Hospital.
He still is, isn't he?
I thought General Hospital ended.
Maybe, but like,
but he was in it from 1981.
Yeah, to the end.
To 2021.
Yeah, yeah. And he's and there was another actress in this actually that's also in General Hospital for roughly the same amount of time. And so, like, he's in all the big soap operas. I find that interesting that you say, like, the one with the first openly Australian accent in an American product. I wonder what that is. Like, was the Australian identity, persona, accent not yet manufactured? And was it with people like him coming on to the scene? And, like, I know there's a lot of factors of why America became fascinated with Australia as, like, this little pet project. But, like, film-wise and television-wise, it is interesting that the Australians were, like, held back from existence when it's, like, in movies, English-speaking-wise, it was, like, Americans and English. Mm-hmm. That's it. You didn't have New Zealand or South Africans or Australians or Canadians. It's like you are American or British. And I wonder what changed that. Like, what was the turning points there? Just like, just time in general? Or like people like him just coming along and being too sexy with that accent? Because I will say, he had a sexy voice. There were some phrases he said that were like so Australian and like his gruff, like the gruffness of his voice, that I felt secure in a lot of ways. Because I'm like, I've heard people talk like that.
Yeah.
This guy's real.
There were moments where I was just like, oh, that really is authentic.
It was a little bit of a security there, right? Because we're so used to these fake ones that overdo it or, like, don't hit the right kind of, like, inflections here and there. So to actually have one. But then, Rachel, he's, you know, he's one of the most disgusting characters in Babylon 5. Like, I almost can't forgive Tristan for doing this to Australians. I'm sorry, Tristan, but you did this. Mm-hmm. You ruined us. You ruined us in B5. Like, now everyone who listens to this podcast are thinking, oh, there's xenophobes too. I mean, I watched this episode of Babylon 5, and he's like the only real Australian in the fucking show. Thanks, Tristan. Anything else you want to state about our boy?
So there is one other thing, but I feel a bit weird bringing it up.
Okay, Rachel. Yes, he has a magnum-sized dong, but what else?
Well, when he was filming this episode of Babylon 5, according to what information I could find, he was actually under probation for a DUI.
What?
which, you know, links to Australians being known as heavy drinkers.
Tristan, bad boy.
He was also in some interesting Australian shows because I went back. He was in Number 96.
That was a big show. That was like pre-Neighbours, Neighbours, right?
A big show and known for being really fucking horny, if I remember correctly.
I mean, did you find this guy sexy?
Reasonably.
Well, was his overt xenophobia too repellent?
Yeah.
Like the character.
Yeah.
I don't know about the real guy.
Couldn't behalf that. He's Robert Scorpio in General Hospital.
Was there ever a boat explosion, or did you two just go off on some mission and then when she missed me, she decided to get in touch with me?
Your mother doesn't know I'm alive.
So you left her to grieve for you. You know, she lost her memory. She spent years trying to remember what
happened. I need to explain this to you, otherwise you're never going to understand.
You let me believe that you were dead.
What would you give the war prayer? A yum being bad or a yum yum being good?
Yum yum?
Yum yum.
Because I don't think it's bad, but I don't think it's good, and I can't give it a half yum, so. So I'm going to bump it up.
Okay. I'm a yum.
Yum.
As much as I love the Londo stuff, and it is very good Londo stuff, iconically good Londo stuff, the actual episode that it's contained in is a mess and a half. It's very sloppily done. Like, this is one of those ones that I imagine if the writers came back to it now, they would make it better, not just because of the context of the modern day, but just as writers, I don't feel like this was their best work.
I do give, if I could give separate parts, separate ratings, A plot, yum, B plot, yum, yum.
What are we going to be watching next week on Babylon 5?
On an all-new Babylon 5.
And the sky full of stars. Mm-hmm. What happened when Sinclair blacked out while leading his fighter squad during the fierce Earth Minbari War? The answer is so vital to an Earth-based supremacist group that it sends two covert knights to cyberlock onto the commander's memories.
It's been a little while since I've watched this episode, but I am going to be keen to note how this one will do how it will present the bigotry of Earth in comparison to the one that we've just covered. I wonder if this one will be better at doing it or not, because like you said, this is also a supremacy group that's come in and they're trying to figure out what's going on with these damned Minbaris invading our society. So we'll see next time on Yum Yum 5, in which we'll be talking about that. And what an experience.
If they want more Babylon 5 related content.
Well, do we do any more Babylon 5 related content on our Patreon?
Not directly on the Patreon. I was thinking more of the various social medias where we post about Babylon 5.
So People, you can find us on the social medias of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, so on and so forth. We're on all of those. It's all in the description. Yum Yum Pod, a Yum Yum podcast. We are always posting things on there, whether they be memes or further discussion points. Follow us on there. Engage with us. It is a great time to be had. You can listen to us on all your podcatchers of choice, including YouTube. I think we need to plug that. Some people don't realize that we have YouTube as well. We also like to publish our episodes on there. I do know some people like to listen on there. So if you have not subscribed to our YouTube, subscribe to Spotify, Apple, whichever you use,
and
listen to us on it.
And if you're feeling extra generous and you want to show your hatred for that sweater, you can make a comment about that in a 5-star review.
Yes. Give us a yum yum review on any of those podcatchers that can allow you to
You can also post a detailed review of that sweater over on our Discord.
Oh, but you can only get the Discord if you are supporting us on Patreon. Yes, our Patreon, in which we have many different tiers with many different things. We talk about the Star Trek movies on there, the best and worst rated episodes of Star Trek. We give our thoughts on other pieces of media, whether they be other TV shows, other movies, other podcasts. Follow us, support us on there, get on that group, Discord channel, it's all happening, it's all in the description below. Do your due diligence, people. I thought I knew you. You were supporting us. I thought that you would know to do that already, but if you haven't done it already, make sure to do so, or I will be very very disappointed, and I'll have to test your loyalty by dragging out some fish head alien, and you'll have to shoot them to prove yourself. But that's the episode, Rachel. I don't know if it's appropriate to end this with good eating to you as usual, because Jakar did put forth a new thing that is very tempting. Yeah. Which is just pouchling, like, don't treat me like a pouchling. But, Rachel, good pouchling to you.